Welcome to this podcast, where we're joined by Dr. Simon Weston, CEO and founder of the Eco Leadership Institute. In this podcast, we speak about the idea of the five-frame eco leadership system that Simon Weston has created, the idea of to leading a good life, but also building a good society, and the importance of systems in this work. He also touches on this idea of moving from a way of thinking that's very scientific, where we've come from, to this more magical idea of re-enchanting, which looks different for each of us, depending on our location, our age, our background, and so on. He speaks to the idea of environment, technology, and people, and how these interact continuously within systems and the impact that can have. We speak about leadership from the edge, the fact that change happens from the edges in, not from the centre outwards, and the importance of creating ecosystems to support people to be leaders in those systems. He speaks to reflection and getting rid of that idea of using a reflective practice. It's too thought-provoking, it's too internalised. And actually, what's most needed is actually this idea of composting and weaving, to understand our learnings and takeaways and to bring them into a system in itself. He speaks about moving from modernist age to a precarious interdependent age that we are moving into as we speak. The opportunity in that, the hope in that, to be more alive, more aware, and to see this aspect of enchantment. And lastly, he invites us to find the quiet and listen to yourself. Hi, I'm Emily Walker.
And I'm Johnny Hammond, and today we are joined by Dr. Simon Weston, CEO and founder of the Eco Leadership Institute. Simon is a leading academic and practitioner in coaching and leadership, a past president of the International Society for the Psychoanalytic Study of Organizations, director of coaching and organizational master's courses at leading universities. And Simon is also an author. He's got a book coming out at the end of this year called Entanglement. He hosts his own podcast and has designed a unique diploma in leadership coaching founded on the five-frame eco leadership system, which he developed through years of extensive experience in diverse organizations, coaching, and leadership. All of Simon's work emerges from a critical and ethical perspective. A belief that our collective task is to work in good faith to build the good society.
So, hi Simon, it's great to have you here.
Hi, Emily. Hi, Johnny. Good to be here.
So, we'd really love to know, particularly for our listeners, those who don't know about this, but we'd love to know more about the five-frame eco-leadership system that we've heard there.
Yeah, so it emerged from work I was doing. So let me tell people a bit about my background and it makes some sense that might help. So my background is I left school at 16. I got thrown out of school basically, working class area in Bristol, and I ended up working in a factory. And then at the age of 18, I'd done a couple of O levels in the evening classes, went to become a nurse. A general nurse. I did general nursing, and then I switched to psychiatric nursing, and then I switched to family therapy, and then I got interested in why the NHS was being run so badly and it needed new leadership. So I studied leadership, and I also studied psychoanalysis because it seemed to me that rational ideas, people kind of knew what should happen, but there's always something stopping that happen. So like there's some unconscious sort of things going on in organizations which needed addressing. So I've been on this journey, and when I reflect back on it, the journey is very much about kind of initially working with the body. Like the factory was manual labor, general nursing was kind of all about the body. Nurses were closer to the body than any other profession, the living body, the dying body. And then the individual, I did individual work in psychology, and then I started thinking about, well, the individual alone isn't the problem. The individual is often a symptom of a wider problem. So I tend to, particularly with young people, they get labeled as something. They get labeled as some diagnostic kind of criteria. They get treated with medication or something. And I was thinking, well, actually, they're a symptom of a wider problem, which is a family problem, and usually a wider economic problem or some social problem. So I kind of move from the body to the individual, to the mind, to kind of group, small group. And then I moved into kind of organizational consultancy, thinking about kind of the wider organization. And now I write about the about society, about politics, about kind of what's going on in the world from a psychoanalytic perspective. I think about kind of wider implications, because these things are all connected, and very often we split them off. So you train as a coach and you look at the individual and you look at the individual behaviors and their performance. And to me, that's kind of nonsense without looking at the wider system. So the five frames echo that journey, basically. So the five frames, so the depth, this depth approach, relational approach, leadership approach, ecosystem approach, and strategic approach. So the depth approach is about trying to understand yourself in the world, your inner self, including your bodily self, your physical self. The relational approach is about trying to understand how you relate to others and how they relate to you. Very often the latter part of that sentence is missed out. We often think, you know, we coach people to think about how they relate to others, but we don't spend enough time on how others relate to us and kind of what that does to us, you know, depending on your body, your shape, your gender, your ethnicity, you know, you get different projections. Depending on your position in the world, you get different projections, and that shapes how you are yourself. So we look at that kind of reaction, and then we move on to a leadership frame. I've written books on leadership, have a particular kind of view on leadership. And you know, to summarize that, it's the fact that leadership is not just one person at the top of an organization. It's not just the top of a pyramid, a group of people in a boardroom. Leadership can be very much distributed. It's everywhere. It's in ecosystems, and we need to kind of find new ways of understanding that. So we go from depth to relational to leadership, and then we map ecosystems. We think about the ecosystem you work in, the ecosystem you live in, where you can make a difference, who you need to be connected to, where power lies in the ecosystem. So we do an analysis of this wider ecosystem, and then the final frame is a strategic direction of travel. So where do you want to go for yourself? What do you need to do in the next few years for your own personal development? And where do you want to take your workplace? So that's the five frames, and that's where it came from. It came from my kind of lived experience.
I love that lived experience, Simon, and I kind of like, you know, it felt to me that it felt very emergent and unfolded for you. Would that be right?
Yeah, no plans, no plans. I like, you know, I was in a factory, and I was stuck in a factory, and a friend of mine at the rugby club said, my wife's a nurse and they're looking for nurses. So, okay, that seems better than a factory. So I went there, and then, you know, either different interests or frustrations, you know, I kind of took a different path. So I got burnt out as a family therapist. I was working with suicidal and anorexics and very disturbed young people, and like doing it for 10 years in an underfunded system. And then I, you know, it's like I started asking it a bigger question, like, you know, why is the system kind of managed so badly? And then that took me to university business school to study management and leadership.
Do you have a, is there a vision that you have?
I don't have a vision. I mean, I we have a purpose more than the vision. So the purpose of the Ecoleadership Institute is really about trying to live a good life, trying to act in good faith to create a good society. So we th you know, a lot of my life I've been thinking about what it means to live a good life. And if you just focus on that question, like what it means to be happy or what it means to live a good life, you can become a bit narcissistic. So you have to attach it to the second part, which is what does it mean to build a good society? And these things are intricately connected. If you just go for the first without the second, then you're in trouble. So I guess if I have any vision, but I call it a purpose or you know, an underlying ethos of what I try and do, those two things kind of hold that together.
Yeah, it's interesting because Simon, I know you might not have had a listen. I don't know if you've listened to any of our other podcasts, but I talk a little bit about kind of a an awakening I had in my early 20s, again, unfolding different things happening, and had no idea that, something like that was going to happen. But I had this sense of my purpose being shifting interconnected consciousness, but I had no idea how. And I still, it's unfolding to me as to what that means. And so when I saw what you do and what you speak about in terms of everything being interconnected, and I think, Emily, you've got a quote there from your upcoming book. But I think, for me, it really struck a chord that so much work, what does this look like for us to have this good society, because we are interconnected in such a way, and yet we somehow don't seem to realize how interconnected we are. It's almost sometimes with, yeah, I don't know. So I'd love you to talk more about interconnectedness, really, I think.
I mean, modernity has done strange things to us. Modernity has done, amazing things with medicines and built great cities and the great, huge advantages in life. We live longer, most of us anyway. So there's these great advantages through science and rationality and modernity, but modernity is disenchanted us. So pre-modernity, we lived in an enchanted world, and the indigenous peoples remain in that space. They understand the enchantment that everything around us is living and has a life and has a spirit, and their ancestors. Time is different, but modernity kind of disenchanted us and separated us. And I'm not idealizing the pre-modern world easy, because like if you got sick or mental illness, it was a bad spirit, and you could be isolated from a community. It's not all good, but we created what Charles Taylor calls a buffered self. So we buffered ourselves against these spirits, which on the one hand gave us more autonomy, more control of ourselves. On the other hand, it disconnected us. And it's been a massive, massive problem, because like we're so disconnected that we're just destroying the planet we're on. We've lost touch with the kind of ourselves within the world. We've become alienated, we've become disenchanted, we've become depressed, we've become kind of a little bit crazy, really. So our the reconnecting, the re-enchanting is kind of what I talk about, and how important it is. And it's not easy. It's really, really not easy. I mean, I've been at this for years, and I'm a modern person. I'm brought up in modernity, so it's like within me. So to try and become something else or try and move beyond that, I've gone a long way, but I still keep on bumping into my modernity all the time of, the way of thinking, the way of being, so we're very like culturally kind of, disengage with kind of nature. Nature's out there, and nature's something to go and walk in or go and look at. No, actually, we're part of nature. I wrote a seminal paper really on COVID, about like people saw COVID as this kind of external virus coming at us, and I was like, no, it's like we are the, we're part of it all. It's our human systems, our cities, our airplanes, our travel. This virus didn't just spread on its own. It spread because of this human interconnectedness and interdependence. So trying to understand that is kind of a big part of my work.
That's really just loving everything that you're saying there. It's fascinating because, obviously, with this kind of modernity, there's this really shifted from a society that is much more community related as well, and much more, we've shifted to a much more individualistic view of the world. Like you said, that idea of, what's a good life to me? How can I have a good life? What's that going to look like for me moving forward? And actually, like you say, we cannot do that without these, we are part of the systems that we inhabit. We are part of that. We can't do it without considering the systems that we inhabit. And I loved your quote from your upcoming book. You said something like trees in a forest, they're both singular and interconnected. They cannot survive unless they interact with each other and the wider ecology. And, like you say, it's not just about the kind of organizations we're part of, but also the natural world, the systems beyond our human creation as well. And I'm fascinated by this idea of by re-enchanting, the idea of re-enchanting ourselves, shifting from that kind of modernist approach to bringing more of that enchantment into our experience, into our day-to-day maybe. How, and I've got loads of thoughts on that and how that might be, but I'm really curious how you might see that. What would we need to do to re-enchant?
Well, there's not an easy answer. It's not an answer for a universal answer. So it's very individual and very kind of not just individual, but it's very contextualized, you know. So, like, if you're in India, the process might be different to, or if you're in rural India to urban India, depending where you are in life, your age, your all these different things, re-enchantment might mean something else. But to me, you know, Max Weber talked about disenchantment, and Marx talked about alienation. And, you know, people who understood quite early on during the industrial process that this was an alienating process, that we were getting disconnected, you know. So that's, for me, it's really about reconnecting and whatever that means, you know. So for me, it means getting up at 6 in the morning, taking a dog to the beach and going for a swim. And, you know, being in the, you know, being in the water, it's like there's something kind of very special about that, you know, rain, wind, or shine, there it is, you know. And you know, so my office is next to my garden. I grow vegetables, and I make bread. I connect with my ancestors. My mother died, and she was a wonderful cook and bread maker. So, you know, every autumn I make green bean chutney, and like my father grew the beans, my mother made the chutney. This is all part of my own re-enchantment. Like, I have my own pattern, so it's about crafting, it's about using your body, it's about kind of being in nature, being connected to other people, and even being connected to technology. Technology's got a bad rap, and in lots of ways, yes, it should have a bad rap, you know, but it also allows me and you to connect, you know. So it's not, it's about using technology in a way which is part of this. You know, technology has always been part of humanity, you know, from basic tools, Stone Age tools, to now. You know, it's part of us, and it's an increasing part of us. It can be dangerous, but it's part of this interconnectedness. You know, so how do we engage with technology? How do we engage with nature? How do we engage with each other? You know, so I talk about ecosystems being made up of humans, of technology, and of the environment. So these three elements together come together, and that's what kind of makes up the ecosystems we live in, you know. So the question is, how can we kind of be healthily connected within those ecosystems?
Yeah, and I'm curious around the eco leadership in action, Simon, what that actually looks like. You know, you spoke about the five frames there, which are fascinating, but, you know, as a leader, how can I embody that? What does that look like in action?
Well, eco leadership is just my best attempt to try and describe what actually happens in an organization, not some idealistic utopian future, but actually, you know, organizations, they like drawing their charts, their hierarchical charts, and their pyramids, and they like, you know, but actually organizations function because of interconnection, because of eco leadership, because within those ecosystems, people step up and they do things informally. You know, if you look, I worked with a group of master students once, and they were studying organizations, and they used to go, we used to send them into an organization and ask them to observe the organization, like sit in a place and observe. And you get the same reports back and back and back. And it was always about kind of people or power, when the boss walked in, you know, this happened and that happened, you know. And I thought that people are so conditioned just to looking at leadership in a hierarchical place. So I'd ask them to look differently. Where do you see small acts of leadership? Where do you see technology? And they started to see kind of like the water cooler would be like, have its own agency, where it would draw people at 10, 15, or the coffee bar, you know. These bits of technology kind of have agency. They draw people in, and then you get this kind of interaction between technology, the coffee machine, and the group around it, who are having a chat, a community little chat, and you start seeing small acts of leadership. You know, the secretary would kind of get up and help a disabled person or something and lead. You know, so if we look at leadership differently, we see it differently. And eco leadership for me is about amplifying these small acts of leadership, amplifying kind of the potential of everybody, rather than just thinking of it as positioning power. And I'm not against hierarchies or saying they shouldn't be there. It's not some idealistic flatten everything. It's like hierarchy and position power is there within an ecosystem. It's not separate from it. It's within it. You know, how does it influence it in a good or not so good way? How can we amplify leadership from the edges? I talk a lot about leadership from the edge, and that's like a, you know, important function of eco leadership.
Could you tell us about that leadership from the edge?
Yeah, so I mean, in I've studied many things. I studied theology, I studied sociology, anthropology. I'm a curious person, so I have a curious mind. So if you study social movements, I studied social movements and social activism as part of my PhD, and I'm very interested. Like, if you think about the major social changes taking place in the world, they're usually from the edges. A marginal group kind of says enough's enough, you know, whether it's feminists or civil rights activists, or and people like to have a hero leader. So you think about the civil rights movement, and people go to Martin Luther King straight away. He was a great leader, but he didn't begin as a great leader. And he you know, people have the idea that he formed this movement. Well, that's not true. Old women on buses and old women in cafes and young women in cafes and young men in cafes, you know, sitting in seats they shouldn't sit in, risking themselves, going to prison. This movement was going on for quite a long time. And then the elders of this movement said, this guy, Martin Luther King, he's gifted. He's a good orator. We'll put him in front of us. So he was kind of selected by this movement. So this movement started at the edges, and then it grew, and then it selected Martin Luther King. And then, to be fair to Martin Luther King, he was a brilliant orator. He was a very brave, courageous person, and he took up leadership, you know. But it happened that way around. It happened at the edges first. And same in organizations. If you're in a car, I'm working in a car manufacturing plant at the moment, and it's near the edge you need to be. You need to understand what the customer wants. You need to understand kind of what's going wrong on a production line, because at the center, you don't know. So changes start at the edges. So leadership needs to be at the edges where the changes, so they can react to the customer, or they can amplify a social movement or whatever. So we always think of it, you know, we're so top down the way we think.
I love that idea, that sense of changing from the edges, because, like you say, we're often in our own worlds, right? We're often thinking from this point
Yeah.
outwards. And actually, it's really useful to think about, well, what's happening on the edges? What's happening on the edges of, and that might be from an individual perspective, what's happening on the edges of my individual world, or it might be in an organization. In an organizational sense, what's happening on the edges of the organization? Who am I serving? What's happening at the
Yeah.
extremities, and looking for the change there. This idea of, I'm curious how that might look in practice to bring eco leadership into an organization. Where might you start?
I usually start wherever they invite me in. So I don't have a specific starting place. So sometimes it's very senior people, and they've read my books, and they kind of think we need some of this. Sometimes it's somebody at the edge of an organization says I'm really interested. So I go. I mean, I'm very lucky. So I've been working in Rome with a Jesuit leadership program, trying to support Pope Francis' call for synodal church. And I was called in because my work aligns with what Pope Francis was trying to do, which is get leadership from the edge. Like he understood that the Catholic Church is very hierarchical, all the power was centralized, and he also understood that you can't change it from top down. So what he did was bring women into the synod, and bring lay people into the synod, and bring indigenous people into the synod, and bring the environment into the synod, and so I start wherever I get an invitation, and if it interests me and I think there's a potential for change. So, like I say, sometimes it can be very senior, sometimes it can be at the edges, you know.
What most excites you about those changes?
I won't pretend that they're like I go in and there's a massive transformation. It's easy. I mean, often I go in, I get thrown out. That's a usual kind of process. You know,
Brilliant, yeah.
people like the idea of eco leadership, and they bring you in, and then they after a year they think, we didn't mean it, Simon. We actually quite like it the way we were, you know, and
Go away.
go away, you know. So, you know, that's. But I don't get disheartened, because actually what you've done is planted some seeds. And one thing about eco leadership, which I found really liberating. So I used to work in the NHS as a nurse and then as a clinical manager. And then I went back as a consultant. And something as big and as bureaucratic as the NHS can be quite depressing when you're trying to lead change. It can be like you can get overwhelmed by it. It just seems too big and nothing will change unless the government ministers kind of fund it better or something. So you get very trapped. But equally, it's quite nice because you think about change being viral. So small changes lead to bigger changes, and that's quite a liberating thought that you don't have to change the whole system at once. And you so where so I do ecosystem mapping, and we think where on that map can change begin? If I connect Johnny and Emily, maybe they'll do a podcast, and maybe their podcast will lead to something else. And so it's this kind of idea of viral changes, small changes, so I always think that we live in ecosystems, and if you have a small effect on six people in that organization, then they'll have an effect on another 10 each. And
Like that butterfly effect, isn't it? And that little ripple effect, if you like. And it's something that I think we often forget about, is that kind of like, well, I'm only affecting six people here. What's happening? But actually, it can ripple out from there. It can, like virally. Yes, absolutely.
That's how
Go
change takes
further and
place.
further.
I mean, I find it's interesting, Simon. I guess something in me gets very excited about systems. And I seem to be increasingly drawn to it. I did an exercise once, you've probably done it as a leadership coach, which about complex adaptive systems. And there was like 30 coaches in a room, and that exercise, and then you look at two people, they don't know who you're looking at, and you try and form an equilateral triangle. And you keep on moving, and you keep on moving, and you keep on adjusting. And suddenly I had this mental image of like nodes that are just kind of all, they're all connected to each other. They don't necessarily know that they're connected together. And suddenly, when you start to see the system living and breathing like that in an embodied way, I suddenly kind of got it. I was like, ah, okay. Rather than theoretically, I was like, oh, okay. And then they said, okay, well, what will happen if we take this person away, or this happens in the organization and that person has now moved to Hong Kong? What might happen? And suddenly you see all of that, and it really brings it to life, almost like a living ecosystemic map. And suddenly I find that fascinating. And so this leadership from the edges really resonates with me listening to you talk about that. But I find that a lot of leaders don't necessarily see like that, or they're not necessarily as aware, that systemic awareness. And I'm curious how they can develop that.
I mean, it's a massive problem because it's not just that they don't see it, but they're conditioned not to see it. They're trained not to see it. A lot of the reward systems are kind of personal performance, or a lot of the short-term quarters rather than longer-term change. So there's very big systemic kind of reasons why things don't change, and cultural reasons why they don't change. So it is challenging, and even people I know who like the ideas, often they get entrapped by two different discourses at once, two different approaches. So they say, yeah, we like eco leadership, we want to move in that direction. And then at the same time, they use the language of transformational individual leadership or servant leadership, And I'm like, well, servant leadership is still about like the individual being a good person and trying to make change through themselves, perhaps in a bit more humble way than the transformational leadership. But it's not much difference really, because the two things are. It's about using your own charisma or your own kind of goodness to change things, Whereas a systems approach is actually quite different, and it doesn't devalue the individual. I do believe in individual agency. We make choices, and this is important. But eco leadership is not just about training individuals to be eco leaders. It's about training ecosystems to allow leadership to flourish, and that's a very different idea. So you create spaces in an organization where leadership can flourish. That's a very different idea than training individuals to be good servant leaders.
That's fascinating. I'm just imagining how that might happen, where you suddenly open up these spaces for that work to happen. What does that look like?
Well, one really lovely case study we had. I was working for a very powerful leader, and who had a clear vision of liked my work on eco leadership, and invited me in to consult to their organization for 12 months. It's an organization of I can't remember, probably 150, 200 people. It was a leadership organization which was a national organization which is trying to lead change in the education system, in the further education system. And we thought about kind of how we could, if we're going to try and lead change in the wider education system, we should try and run our own organization in a way which is parallel to that, and not kind of have this kind of duplicity of sort of saying one thing and doing another. So we did some work, and it was just very, very interesting. We basically created, we got the whole organization engaged in small group conversations. So we got them in conversations about the strategy, the direction of travel, what this organization should be about. I mean, included everybody, like literally everybody. So if it was a cleaner or secretary or we included everybody, and it was in these hubs. So we created these hubs, and then we collected the information from these hubs, and we put it together, and then we kind of had a town hall event where we shared some of these ideas. And so we did this sort of bottom up kind of piece of strategic thinking, and it was just we called it democratizing strategy. And it was fascinating. And then for the final event, where we're going to kind of bring the key themes and stuff, we actually empowered, we invited people from anyone in the organization could was given a budget to run the event. So it wasn't kind of the HR people or the top OD people. It was like, we actually had people from everywhere, people who'd never taken any sort of gig like that before. And it was astounding, the event they put on. I mean, the creativity and way beyond anything I could have done, or kind of people, the experienced event managers could have done. They went for it. It's like, okay, we've got a budget, let's have some fun, and let's like do this really super creative event, which kind of engaged everybody. So, that was a lovely example of democratizing strategy, of eco leadership in action. It was a smallish organization. It was an engaged organization, so, and it had a very supportive chief executive. So that was one example. In bigger organizations, it's more challenging.
Yeah, it's fascinating because and I'm curious, because I suddenly imagine myself being a leader here, listening to you going, oh, those are really good ideas. I'm really fascinated by this. How do I do it? How do I go about it? And I don't want to distill this down to tips, because I don't think it is possible. But if there are, ways in which leaders who might be intrigued, like that client was, how might they go about starting to begin this in their organization? I know you do a leadership course, a diploma in it, but I think that's for leadership coaching. Is that right? Is that
Well, we invite, it's called coaching, but it's really, we invite leaders, consultants, HR people, OD people, a few academics turn up. It's people interested in organizational change, really.
right?
There's specific coaching part to it, which is, I think, helpful for, I mean, leaders or who get some coaching training is always helpful to their leadership. So, it's organized around coaching ideas, but it's for any change agent, really. And so we run that, and we run internal developmental events, trainings. So when I consult an organization, they usually want me to do something around a 12 or 24 month project, and we create kind of a menu of viral events, but it's very strategic. We think about the wider system, we think about who to invite to events, what we do, a lot of work where it's sort of self-managed learning. So we do peer-to-peer mentoring. So, like, again, we always try and do what we preach, so we say we're not going to come in and just give you this top-down leadership course. We might do some input around that. It's important to understand some theory and some understanding of what changes you need to go through. But then we start mapping the organization, and we pair up people across the organization. We get cross-functional groups, cross-regional teams together. And we create hubs of innovation. And so we do, everything we do is designed to try and encourage kind of cross-fertilization of ideas, learning best practice from each other. And in these spaces, this is where leadership grows. You don't, it's not like we're training leaders. Leadership shows up. If you give people enough self-managed entitlement and some space, people are pretty good. They take advantage, and And particularly around tasks, so we get them to work around different tasks, so it's not kind of just kind of fuzzy, just think about EQD. It's like, apply it to kind of, you're trying to design a new training program, or you're trying to kind of make a certain change in the organization, go for it. And we'll kind of facilitate and be supportive from the outside, but it's your gig, So we it's that's the kind of work we're doing all the time.
And just coming back to something that we talked about at the beginning of this conversation, speaking very much to the kind of interconnectedness, and you mentioned the importance of the kind of importance of environment, technology, and people, and how they interact. You spoke about your vegetable patch. I've got a vegetable patch, and the importance, for example, of things like craft, and actually there was a real sense of embodiment and the importance of not just the kind of the intellect, but also the embodiment as well. And I'm curious how that comes in then when working with organizations, to bring more of that embodiment aspect into eco leadership and this
Yeah.
interconnected aspect.
I mean, it's about finding permission to do things, really. So, I was president of the International Society you mentioned of Psychoanalysis. And when I became president, I thought, I don't want to do it the same way it's been done before, because we'd meet twice a year as a board members. It was international, and you'd start at hotel breakfast and you work through till 7 o'clock in the evening, like, in a stale room with no windows, and I'm like, I'm not doing this. This is this is not my way. So I like,
No.
how can I disrupt this, So I took people to a small island off the coast of Dublin. Beautiful island, like there's two houses on it, and just amazing wildlife. And I took the board there. We went on this wild boat trip. It was a bit bumpy and bashing. And I took an artist with us, and I worked with this group, and we developed the first strategy for this organization. And it was such a creative time. And I said, every afternoon, like from 1 to 3, you're free. You go and wander the island, go and visit the wildlife, go and see the seals, go and see the puffins, And it was just this amazing time. And it was like the amount of work we although we cut the hours down, the amount of creativity and what we produced was absolutely phenomenal. I try and do that. I try, I was in London the other day, and I working with a high tech group, data center kind of group, and they kind of brought me in, and I'm like, I can't stay in this kind of stale kind of room. So let's go to went down the East End to where I used to live, and into the Whitechapel Art Gallery. And I say, look at the art, think about your place, think about locating yourself, think about kind of what your place means to you, and try and sort of use the art as a metaphor, as a way of kind of reflecting on yourself. And I've done the same in the Tate Gallery, so you don't have to be in the countryside. You can be in a city, and you go into a park or by the river. I do observation exercises where I take people into airports or stations, and to observe people, to observe technology, see what they see. So you're trying to make people more aware of their bodies, their place, their location, kind of their context. Lots of evocative training, creative training exercises, which on my training courses now, we don't do reflection anymore. We do composting. We do
Haha, love it.
composting and weaving. And because I think reflection is, yeah, I've been reflecting all my life, but it's a very cognitive idea. But composting is about, I say, now you have to go outside if you can, move your body, eat some food, digest something, and allow what we've been teaching to kind of process, allow it to be broken down into kind of nutrients, and those nutrients will feed new thoughts. But you have to be moving your body. You have to kind of be in, even if you're in a big office, to go and talk to the plants, engage with nature in somehow, and move your body. So we bring the body into our reflective process now, and we think about, yeah, it's just very interesting. People are caught onto there very quickly. They compost now. And then we come back and we have a weaving plenary. So we weave the composting kind of ideas together, and we kind of share, and then we weave together some material we can use
I
for
love that
future.
idea of composting and weaving because it's so much more integrated, isn't it? It's so
Yeah.
much more it's not only getting away from the sort of mental process of just looking back on your own kind of experience
Yeah.
and so on, and unpacking that, it's there's a real connectedness to the sort of sense of what happens when you compost and
Yeah.
cogitate and digest, and then the weaving aspect of connecting that to other people's experiences and how they've experienced it and what's going on for them and what that looks like as a team or a group or and so on.
Yeah,
Yeah.
that's what we do.
Great. Great.
Listening to this, it finds for me, paradigm shift, is coming to my mind, and we're still kind of living in the legacy of the industrial age. For some reason, our culture still has that mechanized industrial, you're talking about Marx. I think it was Marx he said there about knew that we were going to be disconnected when this happened. This was not connecting us in any way. And it feels that we're still suffering from that legacy a little bit, and we're still trying to shake off that paradigm. And there seems to be this emerging paradigm, and I'm just, for me, it's just always fascinated as to how it's taking so long to catalyze in some respects. And maybe it is that it's the leadership at the edges that you talk about. It's these kind of conversations and the pockets at the edges that start to shift that paradigm, and start to, I guess, compost it and weave it and create, sort of weave it in. But for me, that paradigm shift, and for me, I always think, why does it take so long for the penny to drop, for us to start thinking differently to the conditioning that we've had? And I guess that's a question as much as anything else. What are your thoughts on that, Simon?
I mean, I study psychoanalysis because I think we need to understand our unconscious attachments and investments. So, like, we know the world's burning, but do we do anything about it? We're actually going backwards, not forwards. We're making choices which are taking us into even more dangerous sort of areas, and the only way you can understand that is some sort of unconscious denial, some omnipotent grandiosity, some narcissism, some. We have human beings are kind of complex characters, and but there's individuals and there's group sort of behaviors which are very problematic. Human beings are very good at denial. We are very good at denial. And that's me, you, and Emily as well. It's like, we all disassociate. How do we live here in our comfortable lives while guts is going on? How do we? In some ways you have to kind of disassociate in some ways to continue, but no, we're very good at it, and turning a blind eye to what's really going on, and living a kind of a short-term experience, and being overwhelmed by stuff. Like, people are just generally overwhelmed by their own everyday kind of existence. A lot of people are struggling, to pay their rent every day. It's not, some of us are more comfortable than others. I've been unemployed for 4 years. I know what it's like to be on the dole. It's like there's a lot of reasons, but that, I mean, for politicians and for activists, we have to try and find reasons to help people find their way out of that, because quite often we just blame, the bad Trump, or but Trump supporters are there for a reason. They were let down very, very badly, a lot of the Rust Belt people and stuff. So we had to try and understand, the conditions which created the messes we're in. And I talk about this paradigm change, and I write about it, and I say we're on the cusp, and we're moving from the modern age to what I'm calling the precarious interdependent age. And these two words are very important, I think, because modernity also promised stability, clear boundaries, created nations. You knew where you were. It had these kind of ideas of, which got racialized as well. So you kind of got, racial boundaries and stuff. It was a way of thinking, and people want to go back to this sort of idea of a 1950s stable kind of society they imagined was there, and it was probably more stable than what we are now. But we're now in a precarious time, and there's no escaping it. Like, the forces of technology, AI, quantum computing, we're just on a curve. It's go, you know, we're on a curve. It's going up, and it's like, we're that's going to bring precarity to many jobs, to lifestyles. It's creating changes how we relate to each other. You know, since when I think of my younger adult self and now, you know, just the changes I've seen, you know, through mobile technologies and stuff. You know, it's huge, huge changes, really. It's massive, and that's going to increase. Then you've got the environmental climate changes, like, you know, that's not going to go away. That's going to increase, you know. So we live in an age of precarity, and for the people who are suffering the worst part of that precarity, it's going to be very, 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 very troublesome. You know, it's like, you know, desertification of Africa, movement of immigrants north. There's going to be, you know, agriculture, water shortages leading to wars. There's going to be a lot of very, very sad disturbance, you know. But even like middle class professionals, you know, their jobs are more precarious now. You know, you don't have a job for life, your career is short. You know, I mean, I'm job from job man, like, you know, you kind of hope it's going to keep going, but you never know. You know, like, so far so good, but no, we live in this kind of precarious age, and we have to learn to live in a precarious age. There are advantages to it when you're not at the severe end of precarity. When you live in a bit more precarious life, you have to be alive. Like when I was on a dole, I had a young baby with me. I was a single parent on a dole and on welfare. And I was time rich and financially very poor. You know, it was kind of precarious, but I was alive. Me and my little boy, we used to go to the market and beg vegetables at the end of the day. And the people got to know us, and they give us cauliflower. We, you know, we had very good food. I was a good cook, and we, you know, we had vegetable curries, you know, free. And you get to know kind of scams and deals and stuff, you know. So there is, you know, I don't want to dismiss the idea of suffering, that precarity can bring great suffering, but also it can help us think about being alive in here and now, and being more agile and being more aware. And I think there's that part of it, and the interdependence, precarity and interdependence go together. That, you know, the right-wing movements are trying to pretend that, you know, we can have borders, we can shut, you know, stop globalization, we can kind of, you know, and we all know that, you know, climate change is something which is going to impact on us all, that we're all interdependent on each other, we're interdependent on nature, we're interdependent on technologies these days, you know. So it's not a question of is it good or bad, it's how do we live with it? How do we live better in an interdependent world? So these two words, I think, kind of describe the age we're heading for. And it's not about trying to get back to some stable 1950s world. It's about how do we learn to live well in a precarious and interdependent age? That's the question I'm working with at the moment.
And I'm hearing, you know, there's an element of hope there in terms of that precariousness, that interdependent, that precarious interdependence can bring us to a space. If we're not in those extreme areas of precariousness, it can bring us to a space of aliveness, of awakeness,
Of enchantment.
of enchantment. Yes.
So yeah, that's my hope. I mean, that's you know, and I'm aware that I have some environmental friends who say that's naive and stuff, you know, but I think, you know, we're in precarious times, and we have to learn to live in precarious times, and that can be enchanting. There can be an enchantment within that, you know, and perhaps we will, you know. Pope Francis said we have to all live with a little less. I think that's quite good advice, you know.
And you know, just to kind of, you know, just noticing the time and just kind of bring a kind of sense of what we've explored today, you know, we've looked so much at so many different aspects of leadership here, from the kind of emergent five frame eco leadership system in how to lead a good life and the importance of building a good society with that as well. We've talked about re-enchanting, which looks, as you said, very different for each of us, depending on where we're from, where we're located, our age, and so on. The value of looking at things in terms of environment, technology, and people, and how they interact. This idea of leadership from the edge, where change actually happens from the edge, not from the middle. The importance of creating ecosystems to support people to be leaders. The fantastic idea of getting rid of reflection and bringing in composting and weaving, and how that links to creating teams, creating this more natural way of being, and moving, you know, how noticing how we're moving from a much more kind of modernist age to a more precarious, interdependent age, which has got that possibility, that hope of bringing for us a sense of more aliveness, more awareness, and more enchantment. If we were to leave the listeners with one thing that you would love them to do, what would that be?
Quiet.
Quiet.
Find the silence in yourself. Be
Beautiful.
still and listen to yourself, to the world.
I love that. Thank you, Simon. It's been a real pleasure. And I know I can tell you have so much more to say. You've spoken about your book. I briefly mentioned it at the beginning. Is there anything else you'd like to maybe say about Entanglements, which is coming out later in the year?
It's a collection of thoughts over the last 7 years. So I've written short essays. I have a Substack. You can find a few of them there. It's just a collection of my reflections. Sometimes it's about my own life, my own spiritual journey. Sometimes it's about politics. Sometimes it's about big picture culture changes. I write about woke. I write about Trump. I write about kind of visiting monasteries. So it's a mixture, but they're entanglements which I weave together, and there's a sense of wholeness there. I try and share my own sort of experiences as part. It's a bit like my five frames. You start with the depth, and then you go into relationships, then you go into ecosystems. So I guess that's kind of what I do. I find my entangled essays and I weave them together, and they end up in a book.
I love that. And also, you've got a diploma in leadership coaching in September of this year. It's 2025 for everyone listening to this podcast. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, it's got two parts. It's got depth and then it's got systems thinking. So we do a deep dive into depth analysis and relational analysis. And then we go into the ecosystem mapping. It's for coaches, consultants, trainers. It's online. You're very welcome. Contact me if you'd like to attend that. And we're also running a first Soul at Work event in September, which is a 3-day retreat or gathering of people who want to try and think a bit more about how we bring our souls to work. The re-enchantment theme is there, of course. We're going to be reflecting on our own lives and what it means to go to work and have a soul. So you'd be welcome to join us.
Yeah, and you know what? For me, that sense of self with a capital S was very present in this session. And I loved hearing so much, particularly also about when people come together in those different pockets, and you gave examples, that sense of that creative energy that comes together from that connection. And I love the example on the boat, for example. I'm kind of left with a sense of self with a capital S. So thank you for that. It's been a real privilege. And I'd just like to say, as we close, is there anything else, Simon, you'd like to say just as we finish?
No, just thank you, Johnny. Thank you, Emily. It's been a lovely conversation. If anybody ends up listening to this, I hope you enjoy some of it, and I hope it allows you to go away and compost and kind of weave. So that's it for me. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Simon. Well, join us next time for more in-depth conversations about awakening conscious leadership. And thank you for listening. It's goodbye from me.
And goodbye from me.